Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films, The Courier, Under Gods, and Slalom. I have nothing to say. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm doing okay, Jill. I've stumped you with those three titles.
Stumped was not the word. I'm just standing by. I have nothing to say.
Well, that's fair enough. And I have a few things to say. And it's another one of these weeks where our theme this week is that we have no theme. All these movies are very, very different from each other. We go from a sort of a fact-based drama to a total fantasy to a kind of a dark romance. But anyway, let's begin with The Courier, which is directed by one Dominic Cook and written by one Tim O'Connor, and it is it's a spy story, basically. That's exactly what it is. It's based on real life. It's based on apparently things that really happened. It's a British-American production, and I would say that probably the most salient feature of The Courier is the fact that it stars Benedict Cumberbatch, who is, of course, a terrific actor. He's also a very busy actor. He's appearing in a lot of stuff nowadays, maybe ever since he got done with Sherlock, which I thought was a very, very fine series. He's been really just doing all kinds of stuff in feature films. And this is, I guess, the very latest one. And it's a pretty good movie. It's not a great movie, and reviews have been sort of mixed on it. But I think it's a good movie. So Benedict Cumberbatch plays in his usual, appealing and at the same time not clingy way. He plays a man who is recruited by British intelligence to just be a courier, the man's name, by the way, is Greville Wynne, and he is recruited to do a very simple little task. He's a business person, so he is perfectly capable of going off to Moscow, and everybody will think he's just going out there on business and not on a secret spy mission. But his job is to go to Moscow and to hook up with a Russian person who is actually a secret agent helping out the West, and just pick up some documents and bring them back to the Western world. So it's just as simple as that. You're a business person, and you can go off to Moscow, and you can meet this agent over there, and you can pick up these documents and bring them back, and we'll be all set. Well, of course, that isn't all that happens. Things go on from there, and he has to make many, many of these trips, and he is all the time very, very worried that he is going to get caught, that he is going to get thrown into a gulag somewhere. All this is happening, by the way, at least the movie begins during the period of the Cuban Missile Crisis, so we're back in the reign of John F. Kennedy, and the Cold War is really at its height. Poor Greville has a wife and a little kid, and he doesn't want to get caught. He doesn't want his comfortable life to be ruined. Anyway, now he's sort of caught up in this. So the movie proceeds from there, and he ends up making lots of these journeys, and he ends up spending a lot of time in Moscow, and then the Russian agent comes and spends time with him back in England, and so forth and so on. And I'm not going to tell really what happens in the later part of the movies, but let's say this is a movie, and this true story was chosen to make into a movie. And so things are not simply going to continue smoothly, where he does lots of these jobs, and then one day he's told, well, we don't need you anymore, and he retires happily back to his ordinary business life. Things do go astray, and things do end up in a state of great crisis. There's a fair amount of suspense built into the movie, and I found the whole thing fairly effective, largely because there's a very good cast here. Not only Benedict Cumberbatch, but Rachel Brosnahan and Mehrab Ninidze and various others. It's a good cast, but it's really kind of, I would say, dominated by Benedict Cumberbatch, and he's just such an interesting actor to watch. And he used to, you know this, Jill, he used to, when he was somewhat younger, he once said that he looked like an otter, and he did sort of look like an otter. Well, he doesn't really look like an otter anymore. He's aging, and he's aging, I think, very nicely. nicely, and he has a fairly dignified look, and he manages to play this executive, low-level executive, Greville Wynn, with a certain mixture of, you know, a certain kind of a dignity, a certain kind of a charm, even a certain kind of an appealingness without overdoing any of those things. So I would say this is very, very much Benedict Cumberbatch's movie, and it's also a movie with a good story. It harkens back to the Cold War years, and we can remember the great paranoia about nuclear annihilation might annihilate us all. That was still a fear, but it was a very active fear back during the Cold War. And in fact, that's one of the tools that British intelligence uses to recruit the reluctant Greville Wynn into doing their great service by being a courier. In any case, it's a pretty suspenseful movie, a pretty interesting movie, and it's always interesting, I think, to get another little bit of insight into how people remember the Cold War and look at the Cold War. It's an interesting movie, and again, a terrific Benedict Cumberbatch movie. Our second film today, Jill, has an unusual title. It is called Under Gods. It was written and directed by Chino Moya, a new filmmaker who was born in Spain, and I think has a real talent. Although this movie, one thing I cannot say, it is very appealing. It's a harrowing movie to watch. It is gloomy and it is doomy, and it is those things throughout. It has a certain humor to it, but the humor is ever, ever, ever so pitch dark. And, it's basically sort of a science fiction fantasy kind of a thing. And if you're in the mood for gloomy, doomy science fiction fantasy, then you'll enjoy Under Gods, which, by the way, had Ridley Scott as one of the people who was behind making it. So there's a credential for you. His Scott Free Productions was involved in making this film. It doesn't have the kind of hugeness and sprawl that we usually associate with Ridley Scott, but it does have the kind of fantastical and even kind of dark elements that I think we do associate with Ridley Scott. So in that sense, it's sort of a tangentially Ridley Scott type movie. But again, it is very much the work of writer-director Chino Moya. So what is Under Gods about? It begins with, and I said it was gloomy and doomy, it begins with a couple of guys driving around some sort of decimated, apparently science fictional landscape, picking up bodies and throwing the bodies in the back of their truck. And that's what they're doing. And they're cracking their little horrible jokes to each other as they do it. And it's all very, very morbid and kind of sick and science fictional. Sometimes it appears the bodies are not even entirely dead, but that doesn't matter. Into the back of the truck they go. So is that what this movie is going to be? Are we going to have an hour and a half of people throwing bodies in the backs of trucks? Well, of course not. We then start segueing to what turn out to be three separate stories, which are told over the course of the movie. And the kind of the guys throwing the corpses in the back of their truck and talking about their dreams, by the way, they are just basically the frame story, and the real stories take place as we cut away from that. And the first one of these three stories involves a couple who are living in their apartment, and one day somebody kind of knocks on their door, and it turns out to be somebody else who lives nearby in another apartment, and he's locked himself out of his apartment, and it's late at night, and there's nobody available to let him in, and they say, well, you can sleep on our sofa if you want. Well, this is the kind of thing that happens in some movies. And some plays and some novels. The next thing you know, this person from down the hall or wherever he's from has pretty much moved into the apartment and is pretty much controlling the lives of the two people who actually properly live there. And all kinds of dramatic developments proceed from there. But this is not really wrapped up in any sort of a conventional way, because before you know it, we're off into another story. And this one is about a person who is a man who is reading a bedtime story to his little girl. And it's a very strange bedtime story that he is reading. And it sort of segues into a story about somebody who has stolen the plans for a device which is going to generate enormous wealth. But then the inventor from whom the plans were stolen is going to get revenge. And all of this is somehow in this bedtime story that a man is reading to his little girl, and we cut back and forth between him and this this story with the inventor and the person who has stolen the plans, and this one too ends in a sort of a very unresolved way, and now we have a person who has been living in some sort of a horrible prison-like place where he has been living in misery for apparently a very, very long time, many years, until one day there he is out of the prison and back knocking on the door of his ex-wife, who thought he was dead and has married another person. And so that's happening, and we have another story, which is in some ways similar to the first story, because we have, again, somebody else barging into a somewhat contented household and causing all kinds of chaos, and things proceed from there. So, Under Gods has a peculiar title, which doesn't really relate to anything in particular, and it tells three very peculiar stories, which sort of relate to each other, but don't really relate to the world that most of us live in, but they have an interesting sort of dark, morbid, surrealistic, dreamlike tinge to them that I found reasonably engaging. I had a, you know, I had a darkly, morbidly good time watching Under Gods, but I have to say when it was over, I just thought, my gosh, this movie has one mood, which is a kind of a pitch dark, gloomy, doomy humor. There's a lot of ooh sounds in there, but that's, I think, a good way of characterizing the movie. Gloomy, doomy humor. And it's I would say, kind of fascinating in its own extremely dark way. So if you're interested in the sort of very, very dystopian fare, and you don't mind stories that don't really come to satisfactory conclusions, but do come to conclusions, then you'll have a good time watching Under Gods. So it's not a movie I can wholeheartedly recommend, but an interesting and unusual picture. And so many movies just fall into ordinary Hollywood-type formulas that any movie that veers away from those, even if it doesn't do so wholly successfully, has at least a couple of cheers from me. And our final movie today, Jill, again, it could not be more different, Slalom, which was directed by Charlène Favier. It is a French-Belgian production, and it is, yes, as the title may suggest, it is about the world of skiing. And we have here our main character, who is a 15-year-old girl whose name is Lynn Lopez, and she is training very, very hard to become a champion skier who will, she hopes, win the French championships and go off to the Olympics. Again, she's only 15, so this is a tall order. Her trainer is played by the French actor Jeremy Renier, not to be confused with the American actor Jeremy Renner. Anyway, they are the two main characters of this movie. Also in the film is Lynn's mother, who is a secondary character, and various others, especially other members of the young ski group who are all training and, again, all hoping to become champions and go on to the Olympics. So what happens here through most of Slalom, or I should say through a great deal of Slalom, is that we have our young character, main character, Lynn, who is in very, very strict training with her trainer, whose name is Fred. And she's doing very well, and they have their little ups and downs. Sometimes she gets lazy and she isn't training as hard as she should. And she's also supposed to be going to school through all of this. And now she starts neglecting her schoolwork, and that could scuttle this whole thing. And then Fred's girlfriend offers to help her out. And in fact, she can even come and live with them for a while. And that sort of puts things back on the right course again. However, along the way, and oh, you can sort of see this coming, young 15-year-old Lynn gets into a sexual affair with her much, much older trainer, Fred. And it is really a matter of his basically sexual predation. He just occasionally starts lusting for her and can't sort of resist his urges. And I won't tell you exactly where that takes things, but it does take things into some fairly explicit sexual territory. And it's not that these two become a couple, and it's not that this becomes in sort of an ongoing, constant male domination over helpless female situation. It's not that simple, but it definitely turns into a very inappropriate relationship of the older man, who is a trainer, basically a teacher, and a much, much younger woman, in fact, a teenage girl, in fact, a girl in her mid-teens, who is having this very, very inappropriate relationship with this man. And it's clearly not a right thing, and it is clearly all his fault. And so, yes, this movie, which was directed by and co-written by a woman, is very much about current gender politics and what happens when men start acting on what they think is their privilege and their prerogative to act on their impulses and their urges and their lusts, and the kind of toll that this can take on, in this case, a very young girl who's only 15 years old. I have to say the movie does not make her into as much of a victim as it might have, and I was pleased to see that. She is seen as being confused by this whole situation, but, you know, not entirely put off by it, and I just thought that was kind of interesting. This is not a case where we have totally black and white, one is a good person, the other one is a villain. They're clearly it's an emotional relationship, and clearly the feelings on both sides are very complex. But there is no doubt that Fred is the aggressor in this, and that Fred is the bad guy in this, and that, again, it is not at all appropriate, and it's interesting to see how the filmmakers will choose to work this out. It's a very, very well-acted movie. I have to say that Noé Abita, who plays Lynn, is a real find, a very, very skilled young actor, and Jérémy Régnier is a very good actor, and he's very good in this movie. Manages to make Fred sort of a menacing character, sort of a macho character, but a not totally unappealing character, which is very important to keeping us involved in the story. So Solemn is a good movie, lots of good skiing scenes, lots of good snow scenes, lots of cutaways to mountains, which look at the same time gorgeous and beautiful, but at the same time sort of scary and threatening, and that kind of brings out the theme of the movie in a very cinematic way, and it's a very well-made movie. It's not an original movie. It's full of many, many lessons we've learned in so many movies before, but I guess we always need to learn them again, and in that sense, Slalom is not only a good movie, it's a worthwhile movie. So that is my hopping around from one thing to another story this week, Jill.
For which we thank you, and you hop well, David Sterrett, Films in Focus, the films The Courier, Under Gods, and Slalom.